Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Can anyone hear me?
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio, live on UK Health Radio. This is UK Health Radio is the biggest and best talk health radio. Thanks for joining. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the CEOs, founders, leaders and clinicians who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. I'm a founder and CEO myself of a health tech venture called PocDoc. We are making diagnostic testing as accessible as possible by allowing you to give yourself a blood test just using your smartphone. And I'm passionate about the individuals and companies that are changing the world. Thanks, as always, to everyone who's listening live on UK Health Radio. Hello, welcome back. It's great to have you. Thanks also if you're listening on Spotify, Apple, Google, or Amazon podcasts, or watching on YouTube. It's great to have you. I always say at the top of the show, thank you so much for listening. We try our best to put out a great show each week, and we wouldn't be doing this if it wasn't for you guys all listening. So thank you very much. At the top of the show, I also want to thank our show partner, which is ZeroZilchZip.com. That's ZeroZilchZip.com. ZeroZilchZip is the best online retailer of the finest alcohol-free drinks. They have a team of people curating and testing alcohol-free wines, fizz, ciders, beers, and spirits. So everything there has been tested to make sure it's good. So there's no need, like I did at the start of my alcohol-free journey, to kiss a lot of frogs and go through a lot of drinks that aren't nice. They've gone through that. Now, in just after we introduce our guests, we're going to do the catch it. I need a better name for the segment, to be honest with you, but it's the alcohol-free drink of the week segment, as presented by Zero Zilch Zip. Any suggestions as to how we can come up with a better name for that would be greatly appreciated. But we will do that after introducing today's guest. Regular listeners know probably that I'm on my journey of being alcohol free, and just serendipitously, Zero Zilch Zip came on board as a sponsor, which was perfect because it's something that I can talk about and I feel passionate about. And it certainly opened my eyes around thinking and drinking and having more choice around what I drink. So on to today's guest. So today's guest is Scott Murray from Venturi Cardiology. Some of you may have heard him join the show just during the intro. That was because we were having some connectivity issues. But anyway, Scott started as a senior cardiologist in the NHS before founding Venturi Cardiology. We always love having clinician entrepreneurs. So clinicians who have then become entrepreneurs, we love having them on the show because their viewpoint is really unique. They've managed to combine traditional clinical work experience training with being an entrepreneur and going on to solve major healthcare problems. It's always really fascinating to listen to their particular viewpoint. So Venturi Cardiology itself is disrupting in a good way, I would say. So disrupting in a good way, how testing for cardiology and cardiovascular disease is done, condensing into a single day what can normally take months if you follow the normal routes through the NHS and GP network and things like that. Obviously, doing in a day what can take months is a major improvement for patients, and particularly because cardiovascular disease is the single biggest killer of men and women in most Western countries. It's a really critical improving those speeds to diagnosis and treatment. You know, from a few months to a few days is extremely valuable. Obviously, PocDoc, my company, we're very focused on cardiovascular disease with our first smartphone-based lipid test. So it's great to have Scott on the show. Scott, how are you?
Yeah, great. Thanks, Steve. Sorry for the gaffe at the start. I was just panicking that I'd joined the wrong thing. I know you can't see me at the moment. Hopefully that's okay. I don't know what's wrong with the video, but
No, it's okay. We're currently on the radio, so it's all good. And, you know, don't worry. Believe me, if you thought you were scared about joining the wrong call, you've got no idea how scared I was that you weren't going to actually make it on and I would have to talk for a whole hour. So it's all, I'm very, very pleased that you're here. So as you heard at the top of the show, because I want to get your view on this as a professional clinician, the show's sponsored by Zero Zilch Zip, which is a sort of one of the newest and sort of, I would argue, sort of leading alcohol-free drinks retailers. They don't make the drinks themselves, but they've created a sort of marketplace for it. From a cardiology perspective, cardiovascular health perspective, what's your view on? I certainly perceive it as a trend more towards alcohol-free being more accepted, more mainstream in terms of a drink sort of lifestyle and culture. Like, what's your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're speaking to a Glaswegian here, so it's probably not the greatest conversation to have. Alcohol was part of the sort of fabric of life growing up for me, and still is. But it does cause major health issues, and you know, any move to try and get people to be more alcohol free is to be commended. I mean, I think recent studies have shown that actually all alcohol is, you know, to some degree toxic. And I think we did go through a period where there were some studies suggesting that red wine and, you know, sort of as part of a Mediterranean diet was harmless and if anything might have been sort of beneficial.
Yeah,
to some,
like this the whole kind of like glass of red a day type of study.
I mean, I'm still relying on that, to be honest.
Well, I think
I mean, I think the most recent stuff, it is basically coming to the conclusion that it is a toxin, particularly to your liver, which is, we'll probably get onto in this chat, but the liver is just so important. Whilst mine is crying at this moment in time, I'll be hopeful that some of the listeners' livers are healthier.
So I decided like 90 or so days ago just to, you know, give alcohol a little bit of a break, not for any particular reason. More, I was interested in, you know, I've got three small kids and I was just really tired. There's a lot going on at work and all that type of stuff. And I just thought I'd give it a crack. I think that the thing that obviously with any kind of trend, there's like acolytes who are sort of saying, you know, it'll like make you can run 100 meters in under 10 seconds if you stop drinking alcohol and things like that. That's not where I am. I think it's more like it's having partnered with Zero Zero Zip actually. And they've sent me a few of these. They do variety boxes of various different drinks. It's made me realize that there's actually some good stuff there. So it's more around choice. I think it's like choose what you want to do, but don't feel compelled to do either one thing or the other. So, and I think my view is that any improvement in non-alcoholic drinks that still tick some of those kind of psychological boxes. You know, like for me, the idea of cracking open a cold beer at the end of a week, that's really, there's a big plus to that. And actually, like, if it's non-alcoholic and I kind of have a similar level of enjoyment, then like, great.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think they're getting better. The non-alcoholic beers, I've tried a few of those recently. They're a lot better than they used to be. Taste wise, I mean, they used to be absolutely stinking.
Yeah, they used to be horrendous. Do you remember? Yeah, like Caliber or whatever.
Really?
That was bad. So let me do my catchily titled non-alcoholic drink of the week review. Okay. So this week's drink, which we put out on our Instagram and on our LinkedIn pages and Twitter earlier, this came in a box from Zero Zero Zip. It's a non-alcoholic Syrah red wine. Now, I don't know if you drink red, Scott, but I'm a big fan of red wine, big fan of Syrah as a particular grape. I was like, there is no way on earth that this is going to be, that they're going to nail this, right? Because it's such a unique taste. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was the original 0% Syrah by Jose Maria de Fonseca. And it was good, right? It was really kind of good. It had that depth of the Syrah grape, and it had the sweetness. It definitely wasn't grape juice, and it had that kind of tannin alcohol taste, even though it didn't have any alcohol in it. Because I was really worried. A lot of the non-alcoholic wines I've had before, it basically just tastes really grapey, right? Because there's no alcohol in it, and it's weird. It had that sort of bitterness and that kind of strength to it without being alcohol. So yeah, I was a fan, and particularly as it recommended to chill it down, I thought it was great.
Oh well, yeah, there you go. Try that then.
Have a go. Anyway, sorry, go on. What were you gonna say?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you know, alcohol is, you know, one of the factors that is implicated in cardiovascular disease, because it puts your blood pressure up, puts your blood sugar up in some circumstances. I mean, red wines, some of them actually lower your blood sugar a little bit, and I don't know whether that's one of the benefits of red wines. Well, alcohol blocks gluconeogenesis in the liver. Okay. So when you start drinking alcohol, you stop your liver from producing its own glucose, and that's okay. why you get hungry after an alcohol binge, is that your liver's basically, alcohol jumps to the front of the bus and takes oxidative priority. So whatever your liver's dealing with at that time, you know, alcohol takes priority because it's toxic, and it just wants to process it. And in doing that, it stops hepatic gluconeogenesis. If you keep drinking alcohol, you know, at some point you'll reduce your blood sugar to the point where you'll get a hunger craving. So that's why you have to go for a kebab.
That's why you get the munchies. Basically. Okay. Cool. Well, look, let's dive into you and Venturi. And I think that obviously we're, like we talked about in our pre-show call, obviously what we're doing at PocDoc is kind of part of what you're trying to achieve or are achieving in the scope of everything that you're doing. So just let's go, as we said, that the show's generally in these three sort of parts, the origins, what you're doing right now, and then what the future might be. So how was your journey into cardiology as a specialist, like as a specialism? So obviously I'm guessing you qualified as a doctor, but then how did you decide on cardiology, or did it choose you, which is what I often hear?
It wasn't as prosaic as that, but basically my grandfather died of a heart attack when I was five, and I don't have that many memories of him, but I do remember him being a jolly, smoking, drinking fat Glaswegian man. And but I also remember how upset my dad was when his dad died, and having spoken to my dad when I was a teenager growing up, it solidified that. And then I, during medical school, did an intercalated degree with in sports and exercise medicine, a BSc, because I was quite sporty at that point. And that was the module I took was cardiovascular in that. So I worked with Jerry McCann, who's now a professor in Leicester, who's obviously famous for other reasons, but he was my supervisor, and he was just an amazing, inspirational bloke. And we also worked with the Scotland team doctor back then. So we started looking at professional footballers. We started measuring their heart sizes. Mm-hmm. We were interested in why some footballers get hypertrophy of their heart when they're all doing the same training.
Yeah. And had that been done before, that type of research, or were you at the forefront?
They'd done quite a bit on military recruits back then. So there's a famous chap in America called Barry Marin, who's like the professor of heart muscle disease that everyone recognises. Okay. And there's also a pathologist in London called William McKenna, who was very interested in left ventricular hypertrophy back then. And so we were trying to recreate the study that they did in military recruits, where they did the echo scan when they first came to training, and then they all did the same training, and then they did an echo scan at the end, and then they looked at why did some people's heart muscles get thicker and some people's didn't. And we were down that journey looking at blood markers and various sort of genetic things.
And what's the implication of a thick or not a thicker or a thinner heart muscle?
Yeah, so there is a grey zone between just athletic adaption to training and something called left ventricular hypertrophy and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy.
Yeah, so I probably won't try and say that on air.
Yeah, there's a genuine heart muscle disease you probably heard more of people, you know, dying suddenly, and then they find out they've got an exceptionally thick heart muscle when they're young.
Okay.
But there is a grey zone in between there, between pathology and physiology, and we were interested in that grey zone. Mm-hmm. So I ultimately finished my medical training and then chose a rotation in Liverpool, which allowed me to spend a bit more time in cardiology. So I did rotations in Royal Liverpool and Liverpool Heart and Chest Hospital, and then I subsequently just stayed in that area in the northwest in Liverpool and completed my training and became a cardiologist there. And I was interested then at the end of my training in vulnerable plaque, so the inside of coronary arteries and why they cause heart attacks, and why does that happen? How does plaque build? What are the different histological and pathophysiological changes? So I ended up doing an MD in that, a post medical thesis, and that was awarded in 2016. So that was putting catheters inside coronary arteries and using ultrasound to look at the plaque. And I spent a few years then as a consultant interventional cardiologist, stenting plaques and treating heart attacks, but rapidly burned out and sort of then made a switch to prevention.
Right. And when you say burned out, just from a quantified perspective, sort of, I mean, how many patients would you see in a week, a month? I mean, because I don't really have a great sense of the volumes, but I imagine it was quite a lot.
I think it was more that I was doing two roles. So I had a role in Royal Liverpool, which was a teaching hospital. So I was responsible for inpatient care there, but I had this separate job at Liverpool Heart and Chest where I was doing stents and the interventional stuff.
So actual surgery?
That had a separate on-call. So in effect, I had two on-call rotas.
Oh, wow, okay.
And my wife was a consultant.
Oh, my gosh.
She had her own her rota, and we had two kids at the time.
Oh my gosh.
So we kind of came to the conclusion that this was only going to go one way, and that we were really struggling to make it work as a family. And so I moved into prevention, stopped doing the stents, started doing more CT work and preventative work, and then we had a third child.
So just to take the pressure off.
You could tell who won the arguments though.
Okay.
So yeah, that's where I'm up to.
Okay, and so where did the concept for Venturi come in? Like, at what point does that start to become something that you're thinking about? Because obviously, you could stay being a senior cardiologist in the NHS, you know, your whole career and doing various different bits and bobs, and you know, so you didn't. There are a lot of different things you could have done before you get to starting your own kind of venture.
I think it was sort of 5 years into being a consultant, suddenly realizing that, hang on a minute, you know, slightly frustrated by the amount of time it takes to get stuff done. That in actual fact, you know what, we can squeeze everything into a few hours here. And surely that would be a better way.
If everything was kind of aligned.
Yeah. So that's how we came up with the concept, myself and Tom Heseltine, who's my colleague and is now a consultant in his own right. We created this idea when he was a registrar and he was my PhD fellow, so I was supervising his PhD.
Okay.
And initially it was just going to be us doing echoes and above a shop somewhere, and then we decided, well, why don't we just go big or go home?
Okay.
And that's where we ended up getting investment and trying to create Venturi, which has taken sort of the best part of 3.5 years, 4 years. So it was way before COVID that we came up with the idea to try and create a one-stop shop clinic that could deal with the majority of things very sort of expeditiously.
Right. And to kind of what you just referenced a moment ago around the frustration that you had around things taking a long time, could you just kind of give a bit more sort of clarity on what that means? Like what things took time, how much sort of time, like, and what the impact was for a patient or patients?
Well, I mean, the big thing about heart disease is some people's first symptoms, first symptom is death.
Right.
So they get a pain in their chest and then they drop down dead and they've had nothing before. And therefore speed is of the essence, and we just, it just takes so long. If you go through conventional pathways, you have to go to your GP. Your GP has to decide. Sometimes might decide rightly or wrongly to either watch and wait or refer you in. Then the referral takes 6 weeks. Unless it's super urgent, we'll occasionally see them in 2 weeks. But then you've got, if you see them in 2 weeks, you've got a 6 week wait for a diagnostic test. And then you've got a 6 week wait for a repeat clinic appointment.
Right.
So you're already 12, 14 weeks in with your chest pains, for instance.
And presumably there's some quantifiable risk of people becoming either very seriously ill or even dying during that window of time.
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on a multitude of factors. Some people's risks are low and ultimately they don't have cardiac disease. And the symptoms are non-cardiac, but there just is that, particularly those people with family histories and strong family histories of heart events in the 40s and 50s and 60s, I think they're the ones that worry me most, is that, you know, Shetland ponies have Shetland ponies, and genetically you're going to, if you're, right.
I've not heard that one before. I guess that's like a Scottish take on the, you know, if it looks like a duck.
Yeah, exactly. It's big, right. It's great, it's fat, it's got a trunk, it lives in the jungle. Right. You know, it's one of those sort of issues that I just don't like it when patients are waiting for that length of time to get an answer from a diagnostic test.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, well, look, I think that there's a lot that we can get into now. And also just, you know, on a personal note, to your point around people's first symptom being death, actually that happened to me about 6-7 weeks ago. My aunt had felt dodgy on one day, and then the next day she had a heart attack, died about 6 weeks ago, exact same thing. And up until that point, hadn't shown any sign of heart disease whatsoever. So, yeah, I mean, that's a very prescient example for me and my family personally at the moment.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. It's so I completely kind of, and when I was 14, my dad had a huge stroke, which was related to cardiovascular disease. So it's kind of amazing how many people in this space or just in health tech generally kind of do what they do because of a personal kind of mission or story, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, as you said at the start of the show, it's heart disease is the biggest killer. And I suppose that's why a lot of us are involved in it, to try and make a difference or a small difference. It's just one of those things, though. You know, what we've realised with having the clinic is that to get someone in and to be able to process them through in what is 2 hours, and for them to have an ECG, blood tests, a heart scan, an echo scan of the heart muscle, and then have a CT scan of the heart arteries, and to, at the end of it, know what's going on inside, and, you know, having had a look under the hood. It's amazing. We've had people crying in the clinic because they've been so worried, and we give them good news. And we've had other people who are like, wow, I really need to make a change and I need to be referred on. And they've got other things that they need to have done now. And without that, you know, they may have just been had their head in the sand for another, you know, 2 or 3 years, not actioning it. So, I mean, you're probably the same with the point of care blood test for lipids. I mean, that's something that can maybe get someone to take action
and activate
themselves. Yeah,
that's exactly. Our view has always been around there should be no fear around people being told of their status, their results. Like, that shouldn't be kept away from them, and increasing access at lower costs, so more access, more affordable for diagnostics is just generally a good thing, you know, whether it's in the UK or wherever it happens to be. And a lot of people, like you said, exactly that, you know, whenever we go and we've done, you know, lipid testing in big companies and small companies and wherever it happens to be, you always get people that are like, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that. Right. I'm going to do something about it, because they just didn't know.
Yeah.
You know? They just don't know. And until you put someone through a diagnostic, they still won't know. Right. So like, what's the harm in giving people access to this information? Because the worst they're going to do is do nothing. Right. Really. But it gives them an opportunity to make changes and to be more in control. So anyway, We're going to, in the next, my producer Johan is throwing daggers at me because we have to go to a commercial break, but I was just too into what we're talking about. But we'll be back in 2 minutes with Scott Murray, CEO and founder of Venturi Cardiology. And I want to get into all of the details around exactly what the testing is that you do and why you do the test that you do, and what that really means for a patient that might be coming to you specifically, and actually why a patient would come to you as opposed to doing, you know, their own thing and sticking with the normal route. So we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Okay, great.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself on the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchsip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% using the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchsip.co.uk because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with Scott Murray, CEO and founder of Venturi Cardiology. The show today is brought to you by ZeroZilchZip.com, UK's online drinks, non-alcoholic drinks retailer. So Scott, before the break, we really kind of got into a lot of the background around cardiology testing, cardiovascular disease and so on. So just you know, for everyone listening, what mission did you begin with Venturi Cardiology? Maybe even before it was called Venturi Cardiology, like what was the mission?
Yeah, well, I mean, the mission was to be able to give people the opportunity to have diagnostic cardiology tests at a reduced price than you would normally see in normal private practice, like your Spires and your Nuffields, but also to work with the NHS and to offer our services at the same prices that the NHS offers each other's services. So there is a thing called tariff, which is basically the menu of things you can have done in the NHS and how much that costs, or it is provided, funding is provided for that by the government. So for instance, an echocardiogram at £70, a CT scan at £200, those sort of things. So, you know, private medicine and private practice charges a lot more for those tests. And a lot of that is dictated by the private insurers rather than the actual cost. So one thing we wanted to do was shorten the pathway. We wanted to speed up. Mm-hmm. So Venturi is, you know, obviously speeding something up through a particular channel and taking people from an area of slow flow and high pressure to a place where there's fast flow and low pressure. And that's where Venturi Cardiology mm-hmm. came from. So we were, you know, making it less stressful, giving people a nice environment to be in that doesn't feel like being in a hospital, giving them everything that they would need at a lower cost and at a faster speed, and at trying to solve all the issues in one shot rather than having to come back and pay more for your follow-up appointment or etc. It was really to create that one-stop shop. So that's how that's still our mission. And you know, we've been trading now for 10 months. We've seen hundreds and hundreds of patients, and I think on the whole we've done a really good job. The one thing we're kind of lacking with is due to the volume, is sometimes of work that everyone has on is getting the letters out quicker than we could do. I mean, we want to correspond with the patient and the GP, and you know, everything gets done on the day, and the patient gets their, you know, sat down and talked to for, you know, explained everything out. It's great to spend that amount of time with patients, because in the NHS we've got 15-minute appointments, and now we can spend 2 hours with a patient and we can explain things.
And a lot of the stuff you're doing is like, it's not necessarily a binary answer, right?
No,
I mean it takes some kind of getting your head around sometimes, I suspect.
It's all nuanced, and you know, trying to taking the time to be able to explain it to patients. Look, this is what it means for you. This is your risk. This is what where you're at now. The most rewarding thing of being in that clinic is you know, giving patients a great service, which could take up to, you know, 6 months on the NHS. I'm not anti-NHS. I still work in the NHS. I'm sat at my NHS desk looking at my NHS paperwork at the moment. But ultimately, to create something like this in the NHS is like walking through bureaucratic treacle.
Yeah. I mean, and obviously we set up a venture and we've started to do some small collaborations. We were on the NHS Digital Accelerator and things like that. And it's sort of, the NHS is like a phenomenal institution, but it's a huge institution and it's extremely fragmented. And it's okay to want, I think it's okay to want to work with it as well as outside of it at the same time. I don't see any harm in that.
When we set the clinic up and we employed a PR and marketing manager. So there's quite a lot of comms going out and various things going in newspapers and online videos and social media. We got a bit of flack saying, oh, here's a UK trained cardiologist who's now starting up private medicine. And I don't think people really understood that what we were doing was offering the services that you get on the NHS at the same prices for NHS patients, but we're just doing it quicker and all in one day. And that even if I laid on 3 extra clinics in the NHS, I would still be waiting on the tests and the results and the various things that I wanted to do during those clinics. And we'd still be in the bottleneck.
I think what people don't necessarily understand, that this is my experience, you know, anyway, it's like, I'm not a doctor and I didn't come up through the NHS kind of pathway that you did. But I think it's as the rest of the world becomes more on demand, it's harder to understand the disconnect between the different bits of the NHS because people perceive it as one organization, but it's really, really not. So if you go and see your GP and your GP wants you to have a test, they have to effectively ask a completely different section of the organization if they'll test you, right? Yeah. And then you have to go over there and they might have their own questions and they have their own doctors and specialists and so on. And it's sort of exponentially more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, GPs are private businesses that are funded by the NHS. And so, you know, we're different from that perspective in that it's not cost the NHS anything for us to set up. We've bore the brunt of that cost. But we are able to provide first-class, private-like specialist clinic, bespoke clinic for patients to come and get their testing done. So we have been working with the NHS performing echocardiograms and CT scans of the heart to try and help bail them out of the situation they're in at the moment with the backlog. It's serendipitous in a way is that we didn't see that when we set this up. We just wanted to improve, you know, what we could offer. But then obviously COVID happened and these enormous waits for diagnostic tests has meant that actually we're more relevant than ever before.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And actually just for everyone listening, I think more hypothetically, because some people might be thinking, well, hold up a second, Scott's come up with a great idea. Of course it makes sense to put all these tests under one roof. Of course it makes sense to do them all at the same time. Why can't the NHS do that? So how would you, I'm sure you've had this question quite a bit, but why couldn't the NHS do that? I suspect I know the answer, but I think hypothetically for the listeners, it would be good for you to just give us your point of view.
Yeah. So about a year and a half into COVID or a year into COVID, I think the NHS came up with the same idea. So Sir Mike Richards was asked to do a review on how you would solve the diagnostic backlog in the NHS from COVID. And he came up with this idea called clinical diagnostic hubs or clinical diagnostic centres. And they've actually started popping up around and hospitals have been tasked and funded to create these entities. And essentially what he was talking about was what we'd already done with Venturi, a place where you could send patients to get diagnostic tests. The problem with clinical diagnostic hubs and centres is that a GP requests a test the patient goes and gets that test and the report is sent back to the GP. Now, GPs have already got millions of things to do. It's a very, very difficult job to do because you have to be a jack of all trades and master of none, and you've got all of the stuff to do. Now, getting a report back, which is in technical language of a particular specialty that you might not be au fait with, means that you are then, if there's a problem with that, going to have to request a secondary care opinion on that test, which feeds you back into the bottleneck.
Then you're straight back into the system.
Yeah, so you're plugging someone back in to an already overwhelmed system. The thing about what Venturi can offer patients and the NHS, which the NHS has yet to realise this, despite us banging on the door and saying, look, we offer the solution. If you let us complete the patient's pathway and you send us the patient's letters up till now securely, then we will do the test and the patient will be seen by a consultant cardiologist on the day and will be given a plan and the letter will go back and the drugs will be prescribed and we'll get to that point much, much quicker and you won't have to then have the problem of plumbing someone back into an overwhelmed system. So in a way, personally, I feel that Venturi is a step above clinical diagnostic hubs and centres.
Because it's solving an end-to-end issue, whereas like actually getting someone tested quicker and do it, the actual physicality of the test itself isn't necessarily the bottleneck, right? It's everything all around it, because that test generates data, generates results, which in theory needs to be interpreted and distilled into a course of action, advice, treatment, prescription, follow-up plan, which unless it's all in one place, that just creates more workflows.
Yeah, I mean, we again, this is something that we could take feedback on and improve, is that, you know, we still have to correspond with general practitioners to get medicines prescribed, and that is another bottleneck. So we're looking at trying
to
get
pharmacists, because aren't all pharmacists just turning into prescribing pharmacists soon enough?
Yeah, so we're getting to a stage where we're talking with pharmacy groups whether we can have our own prescribing facilities as consultants, so we can take that workload off the GP, because you can see it from the GP's perspective. They don't want more work landing back in their plate. They want to say, let's send this patient to someone who knows what they're doing, and then that's it. I don't need to worry about it. I've got enough to worry about. And so we are working towards, you know, trying to improve our service from that perspective, where we do offer prescriptions, we do offer the full plan, and it all gets sorted ASAP. Because one of the issues we've got at the moment is we're all working hybridly. So we're working one day a week in the clinic or sometimes 2 days a week, and we're working 3 days a week in NHS. And then when we're on call in the NHS, like for instance, when I'm on call, I'm on 7 days, 24/7. So I don't do any work then at Venturi. Or if I'm on the wards or I'm seeing patients in the hospital, we're not working there. We have to be uncontracted from an
NHS. Completely free.
The burden of work that builds in the NHS matched the burden of work that is building at Venturi means that occasionally you get overwhelmed.
Yeah,
and then you're struggling to provide the best service for all the patients. So I think that we you know, a time will come when we need to improve on that if we continue to be expanding and growing.
I agree. I mean, look, and I mean, the NHS has always been under a lot of strain, and it's really held together by the individuals that work in it, such as yourselves and you know, hundreds of thousands of others. It's a very commendable, you know, juggling act, high wire act that many, many people do. So you know, thank you for doing that for everyone. We're going to break for another commercial break in a bit, but just for everyone listening, because I know that I always like to try and ask questions that some people might think are a bit stupid, but might benefit listeners just in terms of like some basic terminology. So echocardiogram, what is it and why do you do it?
Okay, so an echo is basically an ultrasound of the heart. So have you seen a scan that a pregnant woman gets on the baby? And that's an ultrasound, or if someone's had an ultrasound of their kidneys or their abdomen or whatever, that's an ultrasound. But we focus the ultrasound on the heart. And what it gives us is a black and white picture of the heart actually moving in real time. So we're able to assess the function of the heart muscle, both the left ventricle, the right ventricle. We're able to look at the valves, which open and close in various parts of the cardiac cycle. So we're able to see where the valves are leaking or stiffening. And we get a general sense of the dimensions of the heart. And really, it's a go-to test for knowing structure, whether your heart's structurally and functionally normal.
Okay. So
You don't see the heart arteries on an ultrasound of the heart, an echocardiogram. You will see the aorta, which is the main blood vessel that comes out the heart, which takes blood around the body, but you won't see the coronary arteries where heart attacks happen.
Okay. And then you also mentioned CT. So what's the difference between an echo and a CT, and why would you do one or not the other? And because these are two of the key tests that you do at Venturi.
That
in theory could take weeks or months to sort of get through without knocking the NHS, but if you went that way.
Yeah, so CT is different in that we use that primarily to look at the heart arteries, the main branches of blood supply to the heart muscle, and that's where heart attacks happen. So we look at UCT, and CT uses X-ray. So you're being exposed to radiation by having a CT, and therefore we've got two methods we use. We use a low-dose CT called a calcium score, which doesn't involve contrast and doesn't involve as much radiation, but allows us to see the heart arteries and see whether they're having any buildup of calcified plaque on there, which is a sign that you've got a problem. And we do a more high definition CT scan called a CT coronary angiogram, where we actually inject dye in through a drip in your arm, and we time the scan so that the heart arteries are lit up by the contrast, and we scan when the heart is motionless. And we're able to see the heart arteries in great detail and know whether you're building up any soft or hard plaques there. So that's a more detailed test, but comes with the caveat of slightly more radiation and a higher price.
Okay. Well, look, we're going to break for a commercial break now, but we'll be back up to 2 minutes. And then I want to get into, because I know that you've got some case studies and you hinted at it earlier, where people come in and they're so relieved because they've had their concerns addressed, or, you know, they're relieved or sort of inspired slightly to make changes because they realize that they have to. So we'll dig into that after this commercial break with Scott Murray, CEO and founder of Venturi Cardiology.
The station that makes you feel good.
It used to be hard to find the world's most wonderful alcohol-free drinks. Not anymore. Whether it's a health thing, a lifestyle thing, or you're trying new things, make sure you save yourself on the guessing game of the supermarket shelves and shop with zerozilchsip.co.uk for the world's most carefully curated range of alcohol-free beers, wines, spirits, and more. Health Radio listeners can save 5% using the code HEALTH5. Visit zerozilchsip.co.uk because nothing's better.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest this week, Scott Murray, the CEO and founder of Venturi Cardiology. As always, the show is also supported by zerozilchsip.com. So, Scott, let's just dig into, thanks for defining and explaining what the echo is versus the CT. What difference does your service make to patients or to the people that come to you? What's the impact on people?
I mean, I think it's basically knowing where you're up to immediately. So, we're able to see exactly in multimodality where your heart is up to and give you the exact answer of what your risk is at that moment in time of a heart attack in the next 10 years. And so you got the entire spectrum of patients coming in. You know, for example, we've had 60-year-old mechanic smokers who've ate pasties all their life and are concerned that they're going to drop down dead of a heart attack, come in and get an absolutely clean scan. So their lungs look okay despite smoking like a beagle from the age of 12. Wow. They've got clean coronary arteries, and you think, how is this possible? And then you've got, on the other side of the coin, you've got health conscious realist vegans who come in to get tested, or, you know, I'm being facetious here, but people who are really look after their health, you know, they eat properly, they cook their own food, they exercise, and they come in and they've got significant vascular disease. So, right. You know, it's...
And in that, so in those two extreme examples, because obviously I know you've taken very extreme examples to kind of make a point, which is all well and good, but like, why do those extreme examples exist? Is it purely genetics in that at those extremes?
To some extent. I mean, I think where we're up to with our knowledge is that 50% of cardiovascular disease is genetic, and the other 50% you can do something about. So genetics loads the gun and the environment pulls the trigger. But some people, even though they've got genetics and environmental issues, they seem to scrape through. And other people who are not known to have, you know, known genetic issues have got disease. And the bottom line is, and how we impact patients is, you don't know until you get tested.
You don't know till you know. Like, that's right. Like, what's the downside? Like, go find out.
It's this sort of engineering mindset. I mean, you don't... If you don't measure it, it's not going to get fixed. And I suppose with your lipid work that you're doing, and there'll be many people who'll get those lipid results and now realise, oh my God, my HDL is exceptionally low, or my LDL is exceptionally high, and my triglycerides are high, and I'm on a bad metabolic path.
Well, yeah, exactly. And there's the thing for us around lipids was that, you know, we did a lot of research before we started the company, and the platform next is we're doing one for the type 2 diabetes market called HbA1c and a few others. We've exclusively focused on things where we're in the preventative space, because we believe in this pathway of access to data, understanding of your situation, action to make an improvement to improve your risk, right? Mm. So that actually test things, like you said, what gets measured gets acted upon in a way.
Yeah,
you know, and so that's why we've not been that interested in like the genetic pathway and things like that. When we first started, people were like, oh, can you, because when we first started looking at things big, like the genetic kind of testing explosion was sort of, I guess, peaking. And the truth was, as useful as that stuff is, you can't really do a huge amount with that information. We were much more interested in creating this, you know, smartphone-based life cycle of testing, understanding your biological data, understanding what action you can take, and then creating this virtuous circle. So one of the insights that came out of a lot of the user research that we did amongst sort of, you know, Joe Public was like, I hear a lot about lowering my cholesterol. I got a cholesterol test 8 years ago. My doctor told me to eat like flora and not butter, but I haven't had a test since. So I've got no idea what my cholesterol level is. That's why things like Strava and all of these health and fitness apps work, is because you have the ability to create that positive feedback loop, as in, okay, I know I've got an issue, I'm going to take some action. Oh, wow, look, I've made an improvement. Great, I'll keep doing it. Whereas like, if that's on an 8-year cycle, then it doesn't really work very well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the lipids is a good way of talking about that, because what we found is that there are people who come and know they've got an issue, and that, you know, obviously in any walk of life, you've got people who are extremely health literate and they've listened to thousands of hours of podcasts.
Yeah.
And they've been on YouTube, spend their entire life, and they're in Facebook groups about X, Y, and Z, and all the research has been shared, and with a limited amount of basic knowledge, they've gleaned a superficial veneer of knowledge, and then they're using their own data and trying to interpret that. But often what they actually need is they need someone who is an expert who's worked in it for 20 years to come along and say, look, stop paying 50 quid to some guy in Australia for these homeopathic
pills
that have been touted to you as being able to reverse your heart disease and these sort of things, and start focusing on, you know, dropping down the amount of sugar and fructose you've got in your diet.
The advice for reducing your risk of cardiovascular disease and type 2 diabetes is kind of the same. It's, you know, eat more healthily, reduce the volume of food that you take, you know, don't overeat, reduce your alcohol intake, stop smoking, take more exercise broadly, right? And yeah. So it's not like the actual, and again, we got kind of, people got very fixated when we started around like, well, you know, are you going to do like meal plans and you're going to do all this kind of stuff? And it's like, well, actually, like, there's lots of people doing that there, like that type of thing, you know, and, yeah. And actually there's sort of, there's not a huge amount of like rocket science in that part of it. I don't really think. It's more around, how do you connect everything that everyone agrees to be true in terms of what to do about it with landing that with people so that they understand that they should do something about it, and then connecting them to what they can do, and actually trying to sort of increase the conversion rate, if you, for want of a better word, into actually doing something about it, where I think magic is.
And I think some people are obviously being shunted onto a great health journey by an awakening of their health literacy on the internet, which is a great thing. And they've improved things and they've got better. But I think some people have also been shunted down a rabbit hole that maybe isn't the best thing for them. And I think we have to, you know, embrace the fact that everything's individually idiosyncratic, and what works for one person isn't necessarily going to work for another. Mm-hmm. And, you know, eating, for instance, your keto warrior, who's only eating some people have amazing results from that, but other people, their metabolic lipid system can't cope with that, and they get increases in their lipoproteins, they get triglycerides.
I bet you people are doing the keto diet, right, without even understanding the impact that it could have on their lipid levels.
Yeah,
you're completely right. It's sort of, I don't know, that type of stuff I get a bit frustrated about, because it's sort of like, particularly on social media, and this is sort of what I mentioned about the alcohol-free thing, sort of whatever the particular sort of niche that you're in, there are people there, acolytes, that saying that it will solve the world. And yeah. It's all about context and understanding that there's a reaction and there's an action reaction type thing, right? Like if you only eat fat,
Some people can manage on that. I mean, I'm not knocking in a particular way. It's the same as, you know, veganism. Some people can manage on that, and some people get great benefits from it. But there are some people that it's just not right for. And I think unless you get tested, and look at the response that your body is making to that with lipid tests and with making sure your arteries are okay and these sort of things, then I think you're sort of tunneling down a blind alley. And therefore we do get a lot of people who've come because their lipids have shot up, and why has this happened? And there's just some honest, frank conversations that, you know, your system cannot handle this, and you need to go back to actually eating a more balanced diet, right. And that homeostasis to some extent demands that we eat some element of balanced, you know, sort of dietary requirements.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. So what, obviously you kind of alluded to it through the show, but you've got kind of a lot on your plate, right? You know, even before you start, even before you, to say the least.
My impending nervous breakdown, yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm a father of three small children myself, and, you know, I could kind of empathize, but you've even got like the added layer of actually being a kind of practicing cardiologist on call for 24 hours a day, every other week or whatever it is. So like, how do you, and how have you, kind of managed to stay motivated and, you know, stave off that nervous breakdown and stay on the mission and, you know, manage to function and have a sensible conversation on the radio type of thing?
I think this is the first question I can't answer.
Well, I mean, do your best.
I've got the support of an incredible wife and an incredible three kids and my in-laws and extended family and my parents when they come down from Scotland. They're all extremely supportive of me, and without that I would never have been able to do anything. So I mean, I think I'm lucky in that respect that I live in a nice place. I've got the means to have a good quality of life, which not everyone does. And you know, I take some solace from the fact that I've come from working class beginnings in a council estate, and I've managed to get to this sort of level. So when I wake up each morning and I see my kids and my wife, I'm eternally grateful for that, and that's why I think work you'll always be replaced at work.
Right.
You know, you're replaceable. I'm replaceable here in the NHS. I'm replaceable at Venturi. The investors might terminate my contract next week and bring in another cardiologist. Who knows?
I haven't heard anything about that, by the way.
So I think that we, I suppose there's a mindfulness there in the background. I mean, things I could do better. I could drink less alcohol and I could sleep better, I suppose, and do more exercise. But it's difficult balancing it all up, isn't it? Everyone's in the same situation.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of what you just said. So what's next for Venturi? Where do you go from here?
So we're signing hopefully more NHS contracts. We've just taken over a community cardiology service in Southport, Birkdale, in the north of England, who they've struggled to have a properly set up community cardiology service. So we've started working there. We were looking to get more CT work for the NHS and basically try and improve the process for patients coming both self-paying and privately, so that they do get their letters a bit quicker. I'm probably the biggest culprit myself of being overworked and not getting the letters to the patients as soon as I would like to. Basically growing vertically and horizontally. So hopefully an MRI scanner at the site that we have, so that we can do, I mean, every cardiology potential question can be answered by a top quality CT scan and a top quality MRI scan. I think we could answer most questions there. So we that's the next dimension for us, is being able to afford the upkeep of an MRI, and also maybe look at other sites in the UK with other willing cardiologists who want to maybe franchise a Venturi and have us help them set that up and run it.
Great.
That's where we were looking to the future.
Good. Well, that's super exciting. And so just before we finish, what kind of advice would you give for any to any kind of clinician that is listening, who has an idea of a business, but they're kind of conflicted about whether to continue as a clinician or whether to make the leap or kind of do what you do, which is slightly hybrid, but may end up going one way, you know, as you go through? What kind of short piece of advice would you give just to end the show?
I would get advice, legal and financial advice. We were lucky in that Tom Heseltine, the co-founder, he has childhood friends who are directors, corporate lawyers and corporate accountants. So they came on board as founding members as well. And I think without them and the ability to dive into the venture capitalist area and get funding, this would never have happened. So we were eternally grateful to the wider Venturi team that exists. And so I think you need to surround yourself by people who've been and done that before.
Right. That makes sense. Look, on that note, Scott, it was great to have you on. Scott Murray, CEO and founder of Venturi Cardiology. It was a great show, great discussion. Thanks for coming on. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks, everyone at UK Health Radio, for the opportunity.